Sri Aurobindo, The Synthesis of Yoga. Part 1, The Yoga of Divine Works. Chapter 12, The Divine Work. Page 264. One question remains for the seeker upon the way of works. When his quest is, or seems to have come to its natural end, whether any work or what work is left for the soul after liberation, and to what purpose? Equality has been seated in the nature, or governs the whole nature. There has been achieved a radical deliverance from the ego idea, from the pervading ego sense, from all feelings and impulsions of the ego and its self-will and desires. The entire self-consecration has been made not only in thought and heart, but in all the complexities of the being. A complete purity or transcendence of the three gunas has been harmoniously established. The soul has seen the master of its works and lives in his presence, or is consciously contained in his being, or is unified with him, or feels him in the heart, or above, and obeys his dictates. It has known its true being and cast away the veil of the ignorance. What work then remains for the worker in man? And with what motive? To what end? In what spirit will it be done? There is one answer with which we are very familiar in India. No work at all remains, for the rest is quiescence. When the soul can live in the eternal presence of the Supreme, or when it is unified with the Absolute, the object of our existence in the world, if it can be said to have an object, at once ceases. Man, released from the curse of self-division and the curse of ignorance, is released too from that other affliction, the curse of works. All action would then be a derogation from the supreme state and a return into the ignorance. This attitude towards life is supported by an idea founded on the error of the vital nature to which action is dictated only by one or all of three inferior motives, necessity, restless instinct, and impulse or desire. The instinct or impulse quiescent, desire extinguished, what place is there for works? Some mechanical necessity might remain, but no other. And even that would cease forever with the fall of the body. But after all, even so, while life remains, action is unavoidable. Mere thinking, or in the absence of thought, mere living is itself an act and a cause of many effects. All existence in the world is work, force, potency, and has a dynamic effect in the whole by its mere presence. Even the inertia of the clod, even the silence of the immobile Buddha on the verge of nirvana. There is the question only of the manner of the action. The instruments that are used, or that act of themselves, and the spirit and knowledge of the worker. For in reality, no man works, but nature works through him, for the self-expression of a power within that proceeds from the infinite. To know that, and live in the presence, and in the being of the master of nature, free from desire, and the illusion of personal impulsion is the one thing needful. That, and not the bodily cessation of action, is the true release. for the bondage of works at once ceases. A man might sit still and motionless forever, and yet be as much bound to the ignorance as the animal or the insect. But if he can make this greater consciousness dynamic within him, then all the work of all the worlds could pass through him, and yet he would remain at rest, absolute in calm and peace, free from all bondage. Action in the world is given us first as a means for our self-development and self-fulfillment. But even if we reached a last possible divine self-completeness, it would still remain as a means for the fulfillment of the divine intention in the world and of the larger universal self of which each being is a portion that has come down with it from the transcendence. In a certain sense, when his yoga has reached a certain culmination, works cease for a man. For he has no further personal necessity of works, no sense of works being done by him. But there is no need to flee from action or to take refuge in a blissful inertia. For now he acts as the divine existence acts, without any binding necessity and without any compelling ignorance. Even in doing works, he does not work at all. He undertakes no personal initiative. It is the divine Shakti that works in him through his nature. His action develops through the spontaneity of a supreme force by which his instruments are possessed, of which he is a part, with whose will his will is identical, and his power is her power. The spirit within him contains, supports, and watches this action. It presides over it in knowledge, but is not glued or clamped to the work by attachment or need, is not bound by desire of its fruit, is not enslaved to any movement or impulse. It is a common error to suppose that action is impossible, or at least meaningless, without desire. If desire ceases, we are told, action also must cease. But this, like other too simply comprehensive generalizations, is more attractive to the cutting and defining mind than true. The major part of the work done in the universe is accomplished without any interference of desire. It proceeds by the calm necessity and spontaneous law of nature. Even man constantly does work of various kinds by a spontaneous impulse, intuition, instinct, or acts in obedience to a natural necessity and law of forces without either mental planning or the urge of a conscious vital volition or emotional desire. Often enough, his act is contrary to his intention or his desire. It proceeds out of him in subjection to a need or compulsion, in submission to an impulse, in obedience to a force in him that pushes for self-expression, or in conscious pursuance of a higher principle. Desire is an additional lure to which nature has given a great part in the life of animated beings, in order to produce a certain kind of rajasic action necessary for her intermediate ends. But it is not her soul, or even her chief engine. It has its great use while it endures. It helps us to rise out of inertia. It contradicts many tamasic forces which would otherwise inhibit action. But the seeker who has advanced far on the way of works has passed beyond this intermediate stage in which desire is a helpful engine. Its push is no longer indispensable for his action, but is rather a terrible hindrance and source of stumbling, inefficiency, and failure. Others are obliged to obey a personal choice or motive, but he has to learn to act with an impersonal or a universal mind, or as a part or an instrument of an infinite person. A calm indifference, a joyful impartiality, or a blissful response to a divine force, whatever its dictate, is the condition of his doing any effective work or undertaking any worthwhile action. Not desire, not attachment must drive him, but a will that stirs in a divine peace, a knowledge that moves from the transcendent light, a glad impulse that is a force from the supreme Ananda. In an advanced stage of the yoga, it is indifferent to the seeker, in the sense of any personal preference, what action he shall do or not do, even whether he shall act or not, is not decided by his personal choice or pleasure. Always, he is moved to do whatever is in consonance with the truth, or whatever the divine demands through his nature. A false conclusion is sometimes drawn from this, that the spiritual man, accepting the position to which fate or God or his past karma has placed him, content to work in the field and cadre of the family, clan, caste, nation, occupation, which are his by birth and circumstance, will not, and even perhaps ought not, to make any movement to exceed them, or to pursue any great mundane end. Since he has really no work to do, since he has only to use works, no matter what works, as long as he is in the body in order to arrive at liberation, or, having arrived, only to obey the supreme will and do whatever it dictates, the actual field given him is sufficient for the purpose. Once free, he is only to continue working in the sphere assigned to him by fate and circumstances till the great hour arrives when he can at last disappear into the infinite. To insist on any particular end or to work for some great mundane object is to fall into the illusion of works. It is to entertain the error that terrestrial life has an intelligible intention and contains objects worthy of pursuit. The great theory of illusion, which is a practical denial of the divine in the world, even when in idea it acknowledges the presence, is once more before us. But the divine is here in the world, not only in status, but in dynamis, not only as a spiritual self and presence, but as power, force, energy, and therefore a divine work in the world is possible. There is no narrow principle, no field of cabined action that can be imposed on the Karma Yogin as his rule or his province. This much is true, that every kind of works, whether small to man's imagination or great, petty in scope or wide, can be equally used in the progress towards liberation or for self-discipline. This much is also true, that after liberation, a man may dwell in any sphere of life and in any kind of action and fulfill there his existence in the divine. According as he is moved by the Spirit, he may remain in the sphere assigned to him by birth and circumstances, or break that framework and go forth to an untrammeled action which shall be the fitting body of his greatened consciousness and the higher knowledge. To the outward eyes of men, the inner liberation may make no apparent difference in his outward acts. Or, on the contrary, the freedom and infinity within may translate itself into an outward dynamic working so large and new that all regards are drawn by this novel force. If such be the intention of the Supreme within him, the liberated soul may be content with a subtle and limited action within the old human surroundings, which will in no way seek to change their outward appearance. But it may too be called to a work which will not only alter the forms and sphere of its own external life, but leaving nothing around it unchanged or unaffected, create a new world or a new order. A prevalent idea would persuade us that the sole aim of liberation is to secure for the individual soul freedom from physical rebirth in the unstable life of the universe. If this freedom is once assured, there is no further work for it in life, here or elsewhere, or only that which the continued existence of the body demands, or the unfulfilled effects of past lives necessitate. This little, rapidly exhausted, or consumed by the fire of yoga, will cease with the departure of the released soul from the body. The aim of escape from rebirth, now long fixed in the Indian mentality as the highest object of the soul, has replaced the enjoyment of a heaven beyond, fixed in the mentality of the devout by many religions as their divine lure. Indian religion also upheld that earlier and lower call, when the gross external interpretation of the Vedic hymns was the dominant creed. And the dualists in later India also have kept that as part of their supreme spiritual motive. Undoubtedly, a release from the limitations of the mind and body into an eternal peace, rest, silence of the spirit makes a higher appeal than the offer of a heaven of mental joys or eternized physical pleasures. But this too, after all, is a lure. Its insistence on the mind's world weariness, the life being's shrinking from the adventure of birth, strikes a chord of weakness and cannot be the supreme motive. The desire of personal salvation, however high its form, is an outcome of ego. It rests on the idea of our own individuality and its desire for its personal good or welfare, its longing for a release from suffering, or its cry for the extinction of the trouble of becoming, and makes that the supreme aim of our existence. To rise beyond the desire of personal salvation is necessary for the complete rejection of this basis of ego. If we seek the divine, it should be for the sake of the divine and for nothing else, because that is the supreme call of our being, the deepest truth of the spirit. The pursuit of liberation, of the soul's freedom, of the realization of our true and highest self, of union with the divine, is justified only because it is the highest law of our nature, because it is the attraction of that which is lower in us to that which is highest, because it is the divine will in us. That is its sufficient justification and its one truest reason. All other motives are excrescences, minor or incidental truths, or useful lures which the soul must abandon. The moment their utility has passed, and the state of oneness with the Supreme and with all beings has become our normal consciousness, and the bliss of that state, our spiritual atmosphere. Often, we see this desire of personal salvation overcome by another attraction, which also belongs to the higher turn of our nature, and which indicates the essential character of the action the liberated soul must pursue. It is that which is implied in the great legend of the Amitabha Buddha, who turned away when his spirit was on the threshold of nirvana, and took the vow never to cross it while a single being remained in the sorrow and the ignorance. It is that which underlies the sublime verse of the Bhagavata Purana. I desire not the supreme state with all its 8 siddhis, nor the cessation of rebirth. May I assume the sorrow of all creatures who suffer and enter into them so that they may be made free from grief. It is that which inspires a remarkable passage in a letter of Swami Vivekananda. I have lost all wish for my salvation, wrote the great Vedantin. May I be born again and again and suffer thousands of miseries so that I may worship the only God that exists, the only God I believe in, the sum total of all souls, and above all, my God the wicked, my God the miserable, my God the poor of all races, of all species, is the special object of my worship. He who is the high and low, the saint and the sinner, the God and the worm, him worship, the visible, the knowable, the real, the omnipresent, break all other idols. To whom there is neither past life, nor future birth, nor death, nor going, nor coming, in whom we always have been and always will be one, him worship, break all other idols. The last 2 sentences contain indeed the whole gist of the matter. The true salvation, or the true freedom from the chain of rebirth, is not the rejection of terrestrial life or the individual's escape by a spiritual self-annihilation. Even as the true renunciation is not the mere physical abandonment of family and society, it is the inner identification with the divine in whom there is no limitation of past life and future birth, but instead the eternal existence of the unborn soul. He who is free inwardly, even doing actions, does nothing at all, says the Gita. For it is nature that works in him, under the control of the Lord of nature. Equally, even if he assumes 100 times the body, he is free from any chain of birth or mechanical wheel of existence, since he lives in the unborn and undying spirit and not in the life of the body. Therefore, attachment to the escape from rebirth is one of the idols which, whoever keeps, the sadhaka of the integral yoga must break and cast away from him. For his yoga is not limited to the realization of the transcendent beyond all world by the individual soul. It embraces also the realization of the universal, the sum total of all souls, and cannot therefore be confined to the movement of a personal salvation and escape. Even in his transcendence of cosmic limitations, he is still one with all in God. A divine work remains for him in the universe.